Saturday and a very good chance of rain developing Saturday night and into Sunday. Sunday's high just 82 degrees. 10 minutes after 8 o'clock for WGTD News, I'm Gregory Berg. The morning show is next. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's Morning Show interview was recorded earlier this year. With all due respect to all of the other guests that I have spoken to on the Morning Show over the last few years, I don't remember being as excited as I am today, speaking with one of the finest concert pianists in all the world, Jeremy Denk. He is, in short, a genius, and if you don't believe me, ask the folks at the MacArthur Foundation, who have given him one of their famous MacArthur Genius Fellowships. But beyond that is a career of extraordinary accomplishment. Jeremy Denk has played with tremendous distinction on concert stages throughout the world, and he has now given the world an amazing book, one of the best books about music that I have ever read, a book called Every Good Boy Does Fine, A Love Story in Music Lessons. Surely most of you are aware that if you want to learn the names of the notes on the lines of the treble clef staff, one way to remember them is EGBDF, Every Good Boy Does Fine. Beyond those simple words is an extraordinarily rich and deeply personal book in which Jeremy Denk ushers us into, in a sense, the world of the studio, where one is taught by a music teacher, and the studio or practice room where one goes to learn and deepen one's craft, whether you are a pianist or a singer or whatever kind of musician you are. And this is an experience, of course, for a fair number of people that is entirely alien, foreign, but it becomes remarkably familiar because of the way in which he ushers us into that world with such vividness. The book is published by Random House. Again, it's titled Every Good Boy Does Fine, A Love Story in Music Lessons. And Jeremy Denk, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. What an introduction. I'm honored.
I want to also say that I remember with great pleasure your performance, I think, roughly 5 years ago with the Milwaukee Symphony, when you played Mozart, if memory serves me correctly, Mozart's Piano Concerto number 19. And it was really a lovely, illuminating performance in so many different ways. And I suspect some of our listeners remember that. And I know you have also played with the Chicago Symphony, and we have listeners in Northern Illinois as well who perhaps have encountered you there. What have the last couple of years been like with COVID? I've talked to a number of different musicians and performance artists of various kinds about what a painful time this has been for you. What has this been like for you?
Well, it's been a mix of things. Of course, it was very painful because I was working on a big project, the Well-Tempered Clavier of Bach, and I had a big tour lined up, and it all vanished, you know, in more or less a day. And that had been, you know, a year and a half or 2 years of work. So I was a little demoralized at first, but you know, I enjoyed having a little time to think and a little space to practice without deadlines. Eventually, and of course, I had this book due, so it turned out to be the perfect moment for me to work on this project and to really immerse myself in memories of piano lessons. And So I was saved by the book in a certain way from the pandemic blahs. Yeah.
Very good. I read the essay that you wrote for the New Yorker magazine. I think that was back in 2013, which in a sense is a precursor of this book. And in that you talk about several of your most important piano teachers, and one in particular that we'll talk about at some length. At that point in time, were you already sort of hoping that you might be able to create a book that would explore all of this in even more detail?
No, it didn't even remotely occur to me that that would happen. But, you know, the piece in The New Yorker happened because I, in a way, begged them to write a love letter to my teacher, George Shebeck, in Bloomington. And I, you know, I dithered for a long time, as I do with a lot of projects, but how do you capture the magic of your teacher in words? And they encouraged me to compare Shebeck to an earlier teacher or make it more of a, you know, a narrative. So it turned out to be basically two teachers, right? A story of two very different people who were important influences on me. And I, you know, when I finished it, it got a lot of readers, you know, people, even like science people I know, you know, they were moved by the sense of mentorship and these really fraught relationships that we have with our teachers and how to deal with their influences and when you have to sort of shake them off and when you, you know, anyway, that I was amazed by the response that that piece got and of course, even more amazed to get a book deal out of it.
How much writing have you done? How much writing, serious writing, did you do before that piece appeared in The New Yorker? I mean, is this something that you have all along enjoyed doing, even while experiencing the gauntlet of a professional music career?
You know, I was trying to sum this all up, but basically, in college, I was writing a lot, you know, papers and creative writing stuff, and I loved writing. And then in my 20s, you know, when I graduated, I was like, I've got to get serious about the piano. I'm just going to practice, you know? And then in my 30s, someone said, you know, you really love talking and reading and writing and words, and you should start a blog. And so I did, you know, the very next day. And it felt like a release valve for all kinds of emotions and thoughts about music and life that I had been keeping pent up. So it was the gift of my friend's suggestion that made me start writing again in my 30s. And I had been doing a lot of blogging and then some reviews and some, you know, pieces here and there in magazines about music. So, yeah, I had been writing that by that point for about 10 years, more or less.
I want to be sure to mention that among the most delicious elements in this book, aside from just your prodigious memory, I mean, I'm just really blown away by how you are able to recall in minute detail some of these experiences you had with piano teachers, I mean, decades ago by this point. One of the things that helps kind of bring all of it to life is some of the images that we are given, graphic images of your own writing from some kind of musical notebook that you must have been keeping back in your childhood. Sometimes it is images of music on which you have written in your sort of childish scrawl, and sometimes it is even pieces of music that you have written. I think, I mean, in absolutely handwritten fashion, as a young person might. Tell us about where all of those images actually come from, and how it is that you still have all of that all these years later.
Someone asked me that yesterday. The answer is fairly simple. My mom kept all that stuff. My piano lesson notebook from my, you know, like early teen years. Of course, you know, that just stayed in the closet forever and ever. And my parents were, you know, they didn't clean out that closet. That was sort of my precious shrine of piano music and stuff. So it was there. And my mom, of course, kept my earliest compositions and some music that I used to play as a kid and, you know, and pictures of things. So, and I also kept, you know, for some reason, I kept a lot of English papers and assignments that I did from high school. I kept them in a big box called memorabilia. So I'm lucky to have these documents, and some of them are very funny. I was shocked to read my, you know, this manifesto that I wrote about the ideal utopian society when I was 14 or something. which is mostly about time management, which was always a problem for me then and now.
I want to ask you about the subtitle of the book. Again, the main title, Every Good Boy Does Fine. The subtitle is A Love Story in Music Lessons. Although you've already hinted at what I suspect is the answer to this, I nevertheless want to give you a chance to expand on that and explain how this is, above all else, a love story.
Well, it's a love for music, of course, to start with, you know. The first scene in the book is me encountering a passage in Mozart, which is still one of my favorite moments in all of music. But it's also probably more deeply about these incredibly intense relationships that I had with teachers who were, in a way, closer to me than my parents and my my friends. I didn't have that many friends in junior high and high school. Some. But you know, the way that also, like, certain teachers revealed to me things about music made me feel a love for them that was deeper than almost any other relationship in my life, you know. And I try to write in the book about the, you know, my incompetence at interpersonal relationships during that period. Meanwhile, I'm pursuing kind of single-mindedly this love for music, you know, under the guidance of my teachers. And I hope that people feel that sort of contrast of, you know, emotional intensities of different kinds bouncing off each other in my life. I think that's an experience that a lot of music students have. You know, they get incredibly drawn into a teacher, and it's wonderful, and then it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Jeremy Denk, one of the finest concert pianists in the world and a fine writer as well, as evidenced by this brand new book that has just been published by Random House called Every Good Boy Does Fine, A Love Story in Music Lessons, in which he explores, among other things, not only his life as a musician, but also the powerful relationships that he has had with an array of piano teachers over the years, beginning with his very first lessons that occurred back when he was, I think you were 6 years old when you first started playing the piano? Is that?
Yeah, almost six, I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. Somewhere around there.
And of course, your teachers are a wide array, from people who had been concert pianists themselves to teachers who are more the ilk of what one might find in a small community, earnest and devoted and doing the very, very best that they can. And it's an extraordinary experience for us to meet each of them. And I appreciate the affection and respect and appreciation with which you talk about each and every one of them. I wonder if you could just kind of talk about what it feels like to write about not only yourself, but also about real people, and real people with both admirable qualities and some that are not so admirable. And I wonder, it just feels like a unfailingly honest book. Was it harder to be, in a sense, honest and frank about your teachers as it was to be honest about yourself?
Well, I guess I felt from the beginning that was the only kind of book I was really interested in writing. There are a lot of beautiful classical music memoirs that tend to sort of focus on the glamour and the, you know, the successes and joys of music. And I wanted to write something a little closer to how it felt at the moment. And I feel a little guilty about, you know, talking about, for example, my teacher at Oberlin, who was a wonderful pianist and a wonderful teacher, Joseph Schwartz. But we were the wrong match at the, you know, wrong time, right? He was too much like my father, something, you know, I needed something else and I couldn't quite figure out what that was. And I was 16 years old and, you know, I found myself rebelling against him. I decided to write the book write about the teachers as I saw them then, not as how I would think about them now, if that makes any sense. And that includes, you know, the bad breath of one of them, you know, that kind of thing. The really weird details that become such an important part of your music teacher experience when you're a kid.
And probably things that mattered more now or mattered more to you then than matter to you now.
That's right. You know, for example, like I talk about Lillian Livingston, my teacher, you know, from my age of more or less 7 to 10, and she made me cry more or less every lesson. You know, after or before in anticipation, she had a lot of, you know, standards, and she kept, you know, yelling at me about certain things. And now I've met her more recently, and she's really fun and funny and wild and not at all intimidating, you know. So I wanted to capture that, you know, the youthful experience, so that, you know, parents and students can all appreciate the way that music teaching actually feels, how scary it is at times. And then, of course, at times, you know, like the best thing in the world. Hmm.
I was touched by a moment that you don't spend a lot of time talking about, but the fact that, if I remember correctly, your first teacher, in effect, handed you off to a more advanced teacher because your gifts warranted that. And the same thing happened to me. I'm not saying my gifts are yours, but as a young pianist, one of my first piano teachers essentially did the same thing. And I don't think I appreciated it at the time. I think I appreciate it more after thinking about it and reading your book, what an act of generosity that is. That not all piano teachers are probably capable of doing, of taking a gifted student and handing them off to somebody else to work with because they believe, and probably rightly, that other teacher is going to be able to take them someplace that the first teacher perhaps cannot.
Yeah, that was a beautiful thing. I you know, of course, didn't quite understand it all when I was a kid, but I think my parents definitely appreciated the generosity of that, and they appreciated also, you know, the teacher is trying to tell them, here you've got somebody who could be a musician, and you need to devote some resources to cultivating this ability.
I also appreciated, brought back such memories of my own piano lessons of long, long ago. I think this is when you're talking about Professor Leland from New Mexico State, who was one of your teachers. I don't think that's before you were in college, but he was your teacher when you were relatively young. And you describe the way in which he wouldn't just sort of paste a star on a given piece when you did well, but actually he would create sometimes rather elaborate illustrations to convey exactly sort of the depth of his feeling about how you had succeeded, and once in a while, how you had actually maybe disappointed him. Describe to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, I think he figured out very early on that I would need humor somehow to be inspired and productive. So his wife was also a piano teacher for kids, and she had these little stars, you know, paste-on stars that she'd put on people's music when they did well. And he would draw, so he started drawing stars in my notebook. You know, he was a good drawer also. And, you know, if I played well, it would be like a Superman star, you know, beaming with pride and a smile, sort of chest out or whatever. And then, you know, but if it was not quite so good, they might have one broken, you know, leg and some crutches. Or, you know, they could look just forlorn and kind of droopy. There are all kinds of things these stars would be, but if it was really bad, he once drew a slug for the sheer level of in attention that I had. And once we had these poisonous red centipedes in New Mexico where I grew up, and he drew one of those. It was very hairy and disgusting. And that was, I think, the worst week of lessons that I ever had with him.
As you think about what you were like as a youngster, obviously with tremendous promise right from the start, is it easy to trace kind of a single line in terms of where you were and where you ended up, or in terms of what needed to improve about your playing, what you needed to work on the most? Is that a fairly sort of steady line, or were the issues that affected you and that needed to be addressed Did those actually vary, maybe even wildly, as you grew into adolescence and eventually into young adulthood?
I think it's fair to say, you know, there are some linear aspects to it. You know, you build the muscles slowly but surely, you know, certain kind of skills when you're a kid. But in another sense, your needs change wildly, maybe especially when you get to college. You know, you start paying attention to one thing, for example, rhythm or clarity of touch or whatever you start paying attention to. And then you go overboard, you know, as we all do in life, and you have to start paying attention to other things. And I hope in the book people read it, you know, you need different kinds of teachers at different times. You know, Joe Schwartz might have been a great teacher for me, you know, 7 years later, because he had such a beautiful, you know, lyrical approach and a beautiful frame of the hand. But it was the wrong thing for me at that moment. You know, I ended up really being drawn to this Norman Fisher, who was a cello professor, who was trying to teach me about character and how to animate, you know, pieces of music as if I was an actor, you know, as if I was Laurence Olivier or something, trying to become the character of the piece, the composer, moment by moment. And that lesson became so powerful for me, you know, and I really needed, I drank it up, you know, like crazy, and then it was too much again, you know. So I would say it's both a linear process and a wildly changing, very emotional and very capricious process.
Right.
The act of learning, yeah.
At one point, and honestly, I don't remember if this is in the book or in your New Yorker piece, perhaps in both, but you describe what you call at one point the various species of teacher, the holistic nurturers and the sarcastic berators, the belittlers, the analyzers, the gym coaches, the old hands who believe that musicianship can't really be taught. I mean, the teachers come in all stripes, and I think you are mostly saying that there's probably a role for all of them to play. There is not just one kind of teacher, when we're talking about piano teachers, that is the best kind of piano teacher. And maybe not even a single teacher who is the best teacher for that particular student. It sounds like in your case, you feel like you benefited greatly from studying under different kinds of teachers.
Of course, because, you know, I had piano teachers, and they were amazing. And especially when I got to Shebeck, I felt like it sort of centered my, you know, piano persona in a way. But I can't tell you how important it was for me to study music with singing professors, or even though I make a lot of singer jokes in the book, which I still haven't gotten any hate mail for, but I will, I'm sure. But, you know, singing professors taught me about, you know, melody shaping and the voice and vocal support. And then, as I said, the cello professor taught me so much about how to animate and inhabit character. And then, you know, there were other, you know, I mentioned a lot, Greg Fulkerson, who was a real hard-ass teacher. I don't know if we can say that on the radio. he was truly, you know, he loved to make fun of you, and he chose a very sort of adversarial style. He was very concentrated on, you know, doing what's in the score, you know, as every composer marking, you know, kind of incredible attention to detail. And that was, you know, ridiculously important for me. He showed me so many things about music that I, you know. So I was very lucky that I had so many teachers. At times it was like, oh, God, I'm totally overwhelmed, and I didn't know which path to follow. And that's part of the book, too, I guess.
Absolutely. I really resonated with what you talked about in terms of going to Oberlin, and how you say at Oberlin, my single teacher split into 10 or 20. And by that, you mean that you were accompanying, at the piano, lessons in all kinds of different studios there. And so you were a spectator in other people's lessons, and not piano lessons, but cello lessons and violin lessons and voice lessons and so on. And I had kind of the opposite experience in my graduate program as a singer, pursuing a vocal degree, but my assistantship, graduate assistantship, was as an accompanist. And so I was learning in all of these instrumental studios and in other voice studios as well. But I came away similarly appreciative of how rich that was in terms of seeing great teaching, and once in a while seeing not so great teaching. And I suppose that's also valuable in and of itself.
Yeah, I saw some not so great teaching. I saw all kinds of things, but, you know, another theme of the book, I guess, is that when you're not the student, you know, when you're collaborating with someone else and they're focused, the teacher is focused on them, your ego gets a little out of the way, you know. The lesson's not really about you, and then you're able to learn a little better. I guess I have, you know, a hope that some young music students will read this and realize how important it is not to to surrender a little ego and just enjoy the act of learning, even if it feels sometimes like it's eroding some of your safety, you know, and comfort. Yeah.
I also wonder, particularly at this point as you are reaching college age and so on, in the New York Times review of your book, they talk about how you, among other things, speak very openly about what you were like as a youngster, very much out of step with most of your peers, and the New York Times terms you as socially oblivious. And I don't know if you would appreciate.
No, I think that's the perfect description of what I was. It's in no way unfair. Yeah.
Right. So we've danced around this a little bit, but I want you to talk for a moment about how music was an arena in which I suspect that was not true, or not true to the same extent. Or was it? I mean, some of the difficulty you had kind of out in the real world with kind of all of your peers, contrast that with what it was like, for instance, to be at Oberlin and, for instance, making music in chamber music situations and so on, and just being at a place where so many people took music so seriously. Would that be a chapter in your life then in which, in a sense, that social obliviousness was no longer there? Or were there still instances in which you sometimes struggled in terms of figuring out who you were and how you fit in with others?
Well, you know, some of my social obliviousness was pure defense mechanism. When I was in high school, you know, I was a couple grades ahead because of we moved and it was a school system thing. And so, you know, it wasn't really possible for me to be friends with my classmates, but then there was a little band of us classical music loving kids there, you know, geeks. and we clung to each other, and it was something. But you're right, when I went to Oberlin and to college at 16, a little bit young, I had a very steep learning curve of how to behave around my peers. Of course, there was the joy of being around all these other conservatory students, you know, and I don't know, I forget, there's 600 or 700 of us studying music there, classical music mostly, whatever that term means. And there we can hang out in the lounge and talk about music and just really immerse ourselves and not feel, as sometimes did in Las Cruces, a little bit ashamed or a little bit nervous about being so geeky. But there we could really go for it. But then the wider question, you know, I did all these incredibly stupid things with people during that period because I was, at least in part, completely overwhelmed by various questions like, am I a pianist, you know? Will I succeed in the world of music, you know? You know, do I still need to be the teacher's pet, or can I be something else, you know? What is life for? Stuff like, you know, college stuff. Meanwhile, trying to play the piano, you know, as best I can, and my teacher assigned me all these incredibly hard pieces, you know, and I was struggling with some of them. So there was a lot of stuff to deal with my first couple of years, especially at Oberlin. I think when I went to grad school, that was the time when a lot of pressures went away and I just became focused on my lessons, you know, and music, and the sort of personal dramas began to fade a little bit. Mm. And that was really useful time. Mm.
We're speaking with concert pianist Jeremy Denk, who is now also a best-selling author, thanks to a marvelous book that has just been published by Random House called Every Good Boy Does Fine, A Love Story in Music Lessons, in which he chronicles his life as a musician, including the powerful experiences, life-transforming experiences he had with an array of piano teachers, and most particularly an amazing pianist and teacher originally from Hungary, Gyorgy Shebok, with whom he studied at Indiana University and had really powerful experiences, one on top of another. Jeremy Denk, I think one of the things that impresses me most, but I also wonder about, is what it is like, what it felt like, to want to pay tribute in print to someone who was such an important part of your life, and trying to tell the story in the richest kind of detail that people, including non-musicians, would understand. I should think that felt like quite the intimidating challenge. I mean, one you met beautifully, I think, but how intimidated were you by the prospect of writing about Gyorgy Shebok and your experiences with him?
You know, that was the first impulse of this whole piece. The book wouldn't exist without this desire to capture him, recapture him. In some ways, I felt once I started writing about him that it became easier than writing about myself. He had such a beautiful and unusual persona, you know, walking around the halls of Bloomington Music School in his, you know, double-breasted suit and constantly elegant, you know, delivering these weird Zen sayings and smoking his long-handled cigarette and talking about the immensities of music and then the tiniest physical details and connecting one to the other and always surprising metaphors and ways. So it was kind of an endless resource of joy for me to remember those lessons, both the wonderful things and a little bit of the heartbreak of feeling, you know, as with all your teachers, that you disappoint them at times. And you know, you could spend, broke my heart also to have to leave out, you know, eventually in the final book, we left out a couple beautiful scenes of him teaching, but I put so much of him in there, and I do hope that I managed to do him some justice as a musician and a person.
One of the things he said about you at one point in the time you studied with him is, to you, he said, "The problem with you is that you are a perfectionist." Those words might not make sense to somebody from the outside looking in, and maybe even to certain insiders. They might believe with all their hearts that this is all about perfectionism, that perfectionism couldn't possibly be a counterproductive thing. But clearly it can be when it comes to the piano. In what way were you a perfectionist, or in what way were you demonstrating perfectionism that was a cause of concern for your teacher, Gyorgy Shebok?
As always, I think his word choices were very specific. He didn't say I was too perfect, which I certainly wasn't at the piano. A perfectionist meant that in my desire not to miss any notes or just stay, you know, exactly so and, you know, do my best and escape criticism, I wasn't allowing myself some freedom of music making and sound. And, you know, I wasn't allowing the music to breathe through this desire to stay on the track, you know. I think that's he also struggled with that issue in some ways. And he always said that his favorite moment in a concert was when he missed the first note. So then he could say, now I can actually make music. I don't have to worry about being perfect anymore.
That reminds me of one of my favorite moments, which is when Horowitz returned to the concert stage for the first time in something like 13 years, played at Carnegie Hall in 1966. There is a live recording of that, and he sits down at the piano. I think Bach is the first thing he plays, and his hands come down in this ugly tangle of wrong notes, and whoever had managed the concert nearly had a heart attack backstage, and then from there it was sublime. It was almost as though
he
got all of the nerves of that occasion out of the way and played so beautifully. You describe your first lesson with Gyorgy Shebok as being one in which the whole point of it was, in your words, to ennoble the art of practicing. Describe what he did with you in that very first lesson in which I think you played Brahms. What he did that was, in a sense, going to open the door to a different kind of practicing for you.
Actually, I played, which was a very chutzpah-filled thing for me to do. I played for him a Mozart sonata in C minor. Very stern. And it was the first piece I'd heard him play, maybe, you know, 5 months earlier in Oberlin. And the first thing he did was walk over to a drawing, a Michelangelo that he had on his wall. And he started pointing out, you know, darker lines and fainter lines and all kinds of different lines that Michelangelo used to create this beautiful, beautiful image. And you know, as you may know, Mozart is full of rests, right? Little places where the music stops and then the next bit of music begins. And he was trying to show me how all these different pauses between the musical moments should be different. Some of the lines were darker, some of the lines were lighter. And the whole essence of Mozart, in a way, was to sort of hear the meanings of those silences as they moved from one character to another, and that I should spend more of my time practicing listening to those silences, you know, rather than obsessing about the notes. Yeah? Well, that's a way of ennobling practicing, right? Creating a new purpose for it and sort of also using practicing to think about the style itself. You know, what is Mozart trying to say? So that was classic Sherbrooke, and it almost completely went over my head at first. And only later I'm able to really reconstruct what he was after.
Yeah. I'm conflating that, I think, and I remember that now, but I'm conflating it with another experience in which you sat with him, and I believe you were playing that majestic opening to the Brahms Second Piano Concerto, one of my favorite passages of all. And he had you do something that was really out of the ordinary. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah. That was in a master class in Oberlin. So I was talking about my first lesson with him in Bloomington. But you're right. I played Brahms B-flat concerto, and he had me – I had to enter with a kind of a big bass note leaping up to a chord and again. And he had me envision the low note. He had me shut my eyes, first of all, and then imagine – the low note that I was about to play. And then he's like, also think about the, you know, it's an F, and think about the E right below it and the G flat right above it, and sort of go over the contours of the keyboard in your mind there, you know? And then without opening your eyes, just throw your arm down and play. Yeah? And what do you know? When I played it, it was, first of all, the right notes, and it had this depth of sound and confidence, you know, that was missing before. And what he was trying to show me is that I had, you know, all those years of practice built up a subconscious understanding of the keyboard, you know. I knew where the notes were. And I just had to get out of my own body's and mind, my body and mind's way to find that. Yeah. And it made such an impression on me, and it so instantly changed my sound, and everyone said, oh, my God, that was amazing. And on the basis of that, at least in part, I ended up going to study with him.
Hmm. You, of course, had many important, fruitful years with him. It's interesting. At one point, you say, I was so dazzled by Sherbrooke that I sometimes didn't pay attention to what he actually said. I think that's a really interesting observation. I suspect that happens more often than we realize, where we are so thrilled to just be in the presence of somebody that we venerate to such a degree that perhaps that once in a while gets in our way of our capacity to take in just the nuts and bolts of what they are having us do. Was that a serious issue?
At times it was an issue. You know, he was such a different kind of person than I'd ever really met in my life, you know. So elegant, so from a different tradition, a different value system about music, you know, so un-American. So tasteful, so concerned with questions of taste and never doing too much, you know. And then he had all these, you know, he had the cigarettes and the aura and the sense of, you know, being basically a mystic of the piano. It's true, sometimes it was just so delightful that, you know, you thought you were, if you just imitated Sherbrooke how he acted, that you were playing better, but that wasn't true. He got mad at me a few times about that, too. I was playing Beethoven 109 for him one time, one of the last Beethoven sonatas, and I was playing sort of self-consciously imitating him. And I know this as a teacher now, sometimes, that if you see the student imitating your mannerisms, it's totally horrifying, you know? It's like, no, you can do some things that I suggest, but don't try to be me, because that is it's a dead end street, right? And Shevchuk basically said that, you know.
Is this the occasion when you played for him Beethoven's Eroica Variations?
No, I played one of them. It's a different lesson, 109. But Eroica, he was mad at me too for, you know, basically that. In that case, you know, I took an idea that he gave me about certain humorous aspects in that piece, and I ran with it so far that he was horrified by how over irreverent it was.
Right. He asked you if you knew the difference between character and caricature. And you say the room went silent, absorbing this elegant, lacerating remark. I had converted high humor into low slapstick. And this is, I think, towards the end of your time studying with Shebok, when you began to realize, in your words, that our time had run its course. Explain what it was like when you ultimately returned to Indiana University to do some teaching there, and he was still on the faculty, and now you were peers. This was kind of an interesting shift of roles.
It was very strange. I mean, we didn't see each other that much when I was also teaching in Bloomington, you know, every so often. He wasn't in town that much, honestly, as I remembered from studying with him. He was often in Japan or to France or Canada, where he taught sometimes. But we would go into faculty meetings, and there I would get to see him do some of his famous Shevchukisms. One time the dean wanted to come up with a mission statement, you know, for the piano department. And people were trying to put up various possibilities. And I remember Shevchuk smoking, also illegally. And then he said, "Well, here it is. We want to teach excellent students very well." That was it. That was his lacerating, you know, satire of mission statements. So I saw him, you know, I taught occasionally, I'd play for him, which was a little bit difficult. And then we kind of stayed a little bit out of each other's ways for a while. But I would say it's fair. A lot of the things I taught students had been stolen from him. You know, you have to steal from the best.
Of course, just because one is a superb concert pianist themselves does not necessarily mean that you are going to be an able, effective, even competent teacher. Nor do all concert pianists want to be teachers. What has been the draw for you in terms of wanting to do teaching, even as you have also carried on this extraordinary career as a performer?
I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but it's a little joke that I like to say. I enjoy teaching like any other vice, in moderation. You know, it's very hard when you get really absorbed. I have a really hard time when I'm teaching not getting totally absorbed in the lives and possibilities of the students. And I use a lot of energy on it. So it gives me immense satisfaction to do, and then I can't do it too much because I get exhausted. And it's hard also to go back to playing, right? The bonus is often when you're teaching your students, as I do in the Music Academy of the West in the summer, often for a month, and they're usually there for a month, teaching really gifted young pianists, you learn things from them day by day. And that's fun. You secretly steal from your students good ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think as someone who primarily makes his living as a voice teacher, one of the takeaways from your book, which I am thinking so much about, is when you say at one point, a teacher must destroy complacency without destroying confidence. And there's the rub, because it seems to me that that is not a particularly simple thing to accomplish. What do you think about in terms of making that happen with a given student? Destroying their complacency, but preserving their confidence somehow.
Well, you know, it reminds me. Each student, you can sort of get a sense after, you know, a few weeks' time, of their confidence levels, you know, and what sort of criticisms they can take and what they might need at the moment, you know. I wouldn't say that my skills in that department are the best, but they're okay. And you try to listen to the student's psyche a little bit to see what's the best path forward. I know Shevak probably did that with me a great deal. If he was ever mad at me, it was usually when I was overconfident, which is an interesting problem to have. Sometimes I see that with students. Mostly the kinds of things I teach don't, they're about opening possibilities. So I don't spend much time berating them for, you know, having a memory slip or doing the wrong fingering or any of that kind of stuff. A lot of the students that I teach are, you know, that's sort of past that point. I think it's a totally different and beautiful thing to be teaching kids, you know, in their, when they're kids, right, and teenagers, you know, watching them try to become a master. And that's the skill I wish I had more experience with.
You also say one thing no one teaches you is how much teaching resembles therapy. How have you done with that aspect of it?
Yeah, and then you have to, I think it's wise to cultivate at least one layer of distance from the students, you know, to think about them. It's hard sometimes. You know, a lot of times you feel that some musical blockages are just physical habits, you know, and some of them seem more connected to sort of personal blockages of one kind or another. And it's a very dangerous, you know, you have to tread so lightly and carefully, and you have to really listen to the student also to see how they respond to their suggestions.
Your teacher, Gyrgyrk Shebok, died in 1999, and you tell us that when you heard that news, the news felt like a warning not to waste my life and my time. In the 20-plus years since, how have you gone about doing that, not wasting your life, not wasting your time?
If anything, I don't take enough breaks, to be honest. But, you know, I'm a very obsessive practicer and thinker about music and also, you know, writing, too, in terms of communicating about music. So it's almost impossible for me to waste too much time, which is also a failing. So I think that warning from Shebok stuck to me, you know, but also all the incredible example that he gave of what it is that music making should be about, you know, and actually Norman Fisher too, you know, in a certain way, and many of the others, you know, they are always trying to impart certain values, you know, things that are precious to them too in music. Yeah.
Well, your book explores all of this and also your own life, your childhood, your parents, how they helped shape you, and, of course, how you sorted out ultimately who you are, what is most important to you. And all of it is told so beautifully in your book, Every Good Boy Does Fine, A Love Story in Music Lessons, published by Random House, the author, Jeremy Denk. Jeremy Denk, I thank you most profoundly for writing this wonderful book, and I think musicians and non-musicians alike will find so much that is compelling and illuminating. I'm so glad we had this opportunity to speak. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Thank you to you too for the wonderful interview. Appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at a different kind of genius, an athletic genius, one of the most sensational baseball players that Major League Baseball has seen in a long time. I'm going to be speaking with sports writer Jeff Fletcher, the author of a book called Showtime, the inside story of Shohei Ohtani and the greatest baseball season ever played. Shohei Ohtani is notable, among other things, for being a two-way player at a really high level, a fabulous pitcher and a fabulous hitter both, reminiscent of the great Babe Ruth. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show, just after 8 o'clock. Mostly sunny skies in our forecast today, but a slight chance of a mid-afternoon shower with a high today of 88 degrees. Overnight low of 65, tomorrow's high 86. On Saturday, a lot of clouds are going to roll in, and we have a very good chance of showers and thunderstorms developing Saturday night and into Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake